So Haggai, page 948, reading chapter 1, verses 1 through 11.
A call to build the house of the Lord. In the second year of King Darius, on the first day of the sixth month, the word of the Lord came through the prophet Haggai to Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, son of Jozadak, the high priest. This is what the Lord Almighty says. These people say, the time has not yet come to rebuild the Lord's house. Then the word of the Lord came through the prophet Haggai. Is it a time for you yourselves to be living in your paneled houses, while this house remains a ruin? Now this is what the Lord Almighty says. Give careful thought to your ways. You've planted much, but harvested little. You eat, but never have enough. You drink, but never have your fill. You put on clothes, but are not warm. You earn wages, only to put them in a purse with holes in it. This is what the Lord Almighty says. Give careful thought to your ways. Go up into the mountains and bring down timber and build my house so that I may take pleasure in it and be honored, says the Lord. You expected much, but see, it turned out to be little. What you brought home I blew away. Why? Declares the Lord Almighty. Because of my house, which remains a ruin, while each of you is busy with your own house. Therefore, because of you, the heavens have withheld their dew and the earth its crops. I called for a drought on the fields and the mountains, on the grain, the new wine, the olive oil, and everything else the ground produces, on people and livestock, and on all the labor of your hands.
Thanks so much, Felicity. Please keep those Bibles open in front of you. Yep. That's good. I think I may have told some of you the story before of my friend who visited the Sistine Chapel. He didn't do what we did when we were in the Sistine Chapel, which was let a one-year-old eat Ella's fruit pouch and spray it all over the floor of the Sistine Chapel. But something else, he was there with his wife and I think some friends, and he's there and enjoying the Sistine Chapel. And suddenly in the middle of this, packed hundreds of people at the Sistine Chapel, just hears this in English, "Stop!" And everyone freezes. He's thinking, what's going on? And he looks around. You know that moment where everybody stopped and somebody shouted stop and you realize you're the center of attention? And he's going, what's he doing? And the security guard is pointing at him. Stop, stop, stop. And he's pointing at him and he realizes he's holding a camera. And unless you didn't know this, just if you ever go to visit the Sistine Chapel, don't bring your camera with you. You're not allowed to take photographs inside the Sistine Chapel. So he's the subject of this stop, and he's absolutely mortified. I don't know if you've ever had somebody shout stop at you in your life recently. I feel like as a kid, I spent quite a lot of my life shouting stop at someone. I'm the second eldest of four boys, but my brother is my brother's older than me, but he's not even a year older than me. And for whatever happened, I think the first child is supposed to be the cautious one, and the second child is supposed to be, but we had a reverse. He was the one who'd just go out and do it. All kinds of things, and I spent most of my time telling him, stop, no, don't do that, mostly around water, like when he'd go out swimming too far. One time we were taken out in a boat by a friend of my mum's out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and this responsible adult thought it would be okay to encourage a 10-year-old and 9-year-old to jump out of the boat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and just go for a swim. I said no because I couldn't swim and I was very cautious, but off went my brother in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and this went, I'm like, stop, stop. And I feel like around water, especially, I spent my time saying stop or saying, you know, watch what you're doing. Think about it. It might lead to destruction. One of the themes that we're going to look at in the book of Haggai is a sense, and this comes from all of the prophets, and we're in the minor prophets in the Old Testament, the sense that the prophet's job is to say to the people of God and say to the people of the world, stop. Think about what you're doing. It's a theme that we're going to see that comes up later and later. We've been through three books recently that have had similar themes of God saying, listen, you've got to be careful about your ways because I take evil really seriously. And I don't let evil just go unpunished, unchecked. And I'm going to deal with it, says God. It's a different theme to the book of Haggai, a very specific historical setting. If you look at the book of Ezra, which is some 500 pages earlier in the Bible, but it's actually at about the same time that the prophet Haggai was there, we read something in Ezra where it says, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, so something happened that was predicted by a prophet called Jeremiah, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation. Any, he said, of his people among you may go to Jerusalem in Judah and build the temple of the Lord, the God of Israel, the God who is in Jerusalem. In 586, about 50 years earlier than this, the Babylonians had taken the land of Judah. They were a big force, a big nation, and they came in and they swept through God's people's land. They took Judah, they took its capital city, Jerusalem. Many of the people of God were carried off into exile into a place called Babylon. There they were subject to the Babylonian king, the Babylonian rulers, and they weren't happy there at all. This is the setting for Haggai. What we read in Haggai is that a new king comes to power. What's happened is the Babylonians have been themselves defeated by the Persians, and the Persians are in power. And somebody called Cyrus comes to be the king of Persia, and he's soft towards God's people for whatever reason. And he says, you know what? Exile's over. Back you go. You can head back to Jerusalem, you can go back to your temple, you can go back to your houses. Now, Psalm 137 is a very famous psalm. And in Psalm 137, it's a song, and it's written by the people when they were in exile. You may have heard something like this. It talks about, by the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered Zion, Zion being the homeland. The psalm is about when we were in Babylon, when we were in exile, we thought about our homeland. We longed to be back to the place where we could be ourselves, where we feel our true identity is, and most importantly, where verse 4 of the psalm says, where we can sing the songs of the war. So it says, how can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? This sense that God is far away because they're in a different place. This sense that their true worship belongs in Jerusalem, because in a very particular way, God said that he would meet them in the temple. And amazingly, what's happened is they get what they long for in this psalm. They get to go back. A miraculous turning of the heart of Cyrus of Persia. And you can imagine, or you might think, that the people have longed for this, to go back to their homeland, that it would sustain them for years. We longed for this. We wanted it to happen. They get it. Okay, we're going to put God first. We're going to live for God. Our worship lives are going to explode because we get to go back home. Well, what we read at the beginning of Haggai, chapter 1, verse 2, there on page 948, that Felicity read, these people, that's God's people, say, the time has not yet come to rebuild the house of the Lord. It's about 20 years now that they're back in Jerusalem, back in their land, and they're saying, it's not right yet, not quite right, the time yet to rebuild the temple. And God speaks to them. He says, is it time for you to live in your paneled house while this house, that is the temple, lies in ruin? What's God's issue with the people here? God had promised the people that in a very particular way he'd meet in the temple. He promised David this, and then David's son, King Solomon, built this glorious temple. Now, it fell into ruin because the kings over years didn't want to have much to do with it, and then during exile it completely went into ruin. But God says, if you really want to know me, you really want to enjoy me, you really want to put me first, you need to rebuild this temple. Verse 9, God says, what's happened to you is you've lived for something else. You've gone back, and what you've done is you've built your own houses. You've focused on doing your own thing. And he says to them, has it made you happy? Verse 9, you expected much by building your own houses, but it turned out to be very little. What you brought home, I blew away. Why? He goes on to say, because of my house, which remains a ruin, while each of you is busy with your own house. And so what happens then is, God, we'll come back to this, God instructs the people to go ahead and build the temple. Verse 14, they respond and they do get at it. You've got the people doing it. You've got this governor called Zerubbabel, and you've got Haggai, and you've got Zechariah, another one of the prophets as well. They all work together. We see then that there's this kind of, in chapter 2, this kind of funny parable about how the people are doing this, but their hearts aren't really in it. And in the end, there's this final message from Haggai about a future king who's going to come that'll be picked up in the next two books that we'll look at over the next couple of weeks. We believe that when we read the books of the Bible, that it's worth stopping for. Jesus believed that the Old Testament was God's word itself, that it's God's message. And we believe that as we gather, we take this 20 or 25 minutes together in our time together to say, what does the Bible have to say? And it's not because we're into old books for the sake of old books. There's lots of new good books. It's because we believe that the Bible is actually particularly set apart as God's message to us today. That reading the Bible when we get together in this moment, with our phones mostly turned off, we get to say, what does God have to say to us? It's like we have the opportunity every time we meet together, or every time we do it on our own or in a Bible study, we're saying to God, God, we're ready to hear you speak into our lives. We're saying stop to each other. We're saying it's time to be quiet. It's time to listen. It's time to hear. It's time to hear what God has to say to us. There's a couple of things I want to point out from the book of Haggai that God might be saying. Certainly that he's saying at the time that might apply to us now. The first is this, is that God can make a lot out of what seems like nothing. I know some of you, many of you, have had desperate situations in your lives, really difficult ones. Maybe you're going through one of those at the moment, where you really believe there's nothing can be made of this situation. There's nothing can be done. And maybe even one of the things that feeds that, or is particularly hard about that, is you look back at a time where things were really good, and you think, when's the day going to come when they might get good again? In chapter 2, verse 3, God addresses the fact that the people knew something of the old temple. It's about 70 years at the point that Haggai has written that they had left, and the old temple was there. There were stories about the old temple, and it was really, really impressive. It took years to build, and it was the most amazing building. And he says, who of you is left who saw this house in its former glory? Some people, probably at the most they were teenagers when they left, will have seen that. And maybe it's depressing them, and maybe thinking, things will never be the same again. And God says, be strong, all you people of the land. He says, my spirit remains among you. Do not fear. Clearly these people are looking around and they're thinking, there's no chance that we can have what we once had. It's useless. It's hopeless. And that's an attitude of mind, isn't it? I was thinking about two older women in the church where I trained to be a minister. I guess it's in the Church of Ireland, a Catholic church called a curate, where you're training. That's what I was doing in a place called Green Island. And the church had been started in the 1930s in a place called in Green Island, near Jordanstown, north of Belfast, if you know it. And they didn't put it there because they had some great sense of reaching the people there. An awful lot of Presbyterians had moved to the area. And what did you do? Well, you better give them a church. And so it was absolutely rammed in this new suburb of Belfast, and there were just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people there. The gallery was full, every seat was full. And I think of two women who, one of them had been there at the time and one of them had come a bit later but had a taste of it. And it was the glory days, the great days of the moving out of the suburbs and starting churches, moving out from the middle of Belfast to the suburbs. And when I met these two women, they both amazingly godly women, women of prayer, faithful women, but they took very different attitudes. We'll call one of them P to protect her identity. They're both still alive, well into their 90s at this point. And she was great, great woman, but she was cantankerous as anything. And you knew when you went to see her, you were going to get a little bit of a fight. And quite enjoyed it, we had a great relationship. But she looked back to those days, and she just couldn't see how what we were now doing could possibly bring them back again. She knew in the days where there was loads of kids there was loads of people there, and things had got a lot better in the time of my boss. Had gone really bad in the 70s, really dwindled. By the time the guy who was my boss at the time really had grown. But even still, she looked back and said, these days can never be the same. Well, there's another woman, and we'll call her I, because that's what her name began with. And we'll call her Isabel, because I'm giving you her full name, because I'm being nice, you know, more positive about her. Isabel, she's the very same. She'd come just at the very end where things had been the glory days, if you like, and things had dwindled. And she could have moved somewhere else. She said, I often thought about going somewhere else. She said, no, I really trusted that God had me here in this place at this time for this reason. And I prayed faithfully that things would change, that things would get better. And they did get better in the time of this minister who was my sister. They did. And then I left because a church called Donabate needed to be started. And we left. And there was a little bit of tension in the church a couple of years later. And things really dwindled then. And I spoke to both of those women at that time, and they're exactly as I thought. One of them still hopeful that things could change again, and the other really thinking things will never be like they were in the 1940s when she was a little girl. you know. And but amazingly, in the Spirit of God and the kindness of God, I was talking to somebody recently, and again, God has brought grace to that church, and there's loads of kids back, and loads of young families are back there, and it's thriving again. And it's just lovely to see. And that woman, and both of them prayed faithfully for that church. They did, and they really meant it. It's just a different personality. But God has been faithful. Out of very little, he made much. And I wonder, when you're faced with thinking about things were better at a different time, what do you do? Do you long for the olden days? Think that they can never come back? Or do you trust that God is faithful and he can make much out of very little? Trust in those situations. Maybe in your faith, you had days where you felt really close to God, and you don't feel so close anymore. And you think, maybe those days will never return to me. God says, even out of small things, I can make a lot. So that's the first thing. God makes a lot out of small things. We learn here too that the goal of life, the glory of God, that is God's power and his presence, was very particularly given in the temple. Chapter 2, verse 7 says, God says, I will fill this house with my glory. You work faithfully, and I will appear to you in a very particular and special way. I will come. And if you've read the New Testament, you might be able to think, well, we don't have a temple that we go to visit. We don't visit the temple. What does God say about where his glory in a very particular way is? What's the new temple? Well, 1 Corinthians 3:16 tells us that the people are the temple of God, that God's glory now resides within us. So we're called by God in the same way that Haggai calls the people to build this building temple, physical temple. We're called to be involved in the building of the temple. That every single person, as another part of the Bible puts it, is a living stone. It's developing that metaphor of the temple. That every person is part of the actual temple. That there's stones in this temple. And maybe these people, those of you who think you'd prefer to be the stones that are kind of off to the side and just left for a different time. Or maybe you're the kind of stone that's waiting for somebody to put you in just the perfect spot. It's just right for you. Now, every one of us has a role to play in building up the body and taking our part. It's nearly the anniversary of me becoming an under-9 football coach. It's been a whirlwind. Training every week, match at the weekends, washing bibs, taking up training plans, an average of about 412 WhatsApp messages a week to run this little operation with two others as well. And the commitment level expected of an under-9 football coach is hard to believe. And those of you who've been involved in coaching will know all about it, or you've seen your kids in coaching, you'll see it as well. Sometimes I think about, well, what are we building? And it's great to be involved in coaching. How much time are you investing in the things that you do beyond your work? How much time are you investing in being part of the temple being built? Building others up who are part of it. Encouraging others, getting involved. One part of it is building up what's already here. That you have a responsibility to each other. To care for each other, to love each other, to point each other to the love of God and Jesus. That's your responsibility to each other as a church family, as part of this temple. But then another part is to reach out to those around us. To reach out with the good news. The good news that at chapter 2, verse 9, God says, talks about this. He says, the glory of this present house will be greater than the glory of the former house, says the Lord Almighty. And this is the good news. And in this place I will grant peace. That in the people of God dwells peace. That's the good news that we bring to the world around us. To bring peace to them. And God calls us to be involved in bringing that to Donabate and to Portran, or whatever community you find yourself living in. Whether it's in your work, in your road, or your school, that you bring this good news to where you are. I want to finish by thinking a little bit about that with some other themes that run through here. One of the things that we see at the very beginning of this is that the people are very good at ignoring God. Somewhere around the time Joseph was born, I said to a friend, one of my best friends who now lives in America, that I'd catch with him over Zoom over the coming days. Okay. I kept meaning to do it. Joseph is now 6 months old, and I have not yet done it. Now, I don't know if you put people on the long finger. Are you the kind of put somebody on the long finger kind of person? I think we all do it at certain times. What's going on here is that the people of God are putting God on the long finger. It's not that they don't want the temple. It's not that they don't have some aspiration for it. But right now, we've got other things to do. We've got to look after ourselves. We've got to look after our own things. We'll get to the temple, and we'll build it back. We'll do that. They're distracted by what's in front of them. And one of the things that I think particularly about our culture today that we have to think about and we have to learn is how do we call the culture around us and call ourselves to stop and reflect. We probably live in the least reflective time in the history of mankind. That's absolutely true. We live in a time where people simply don't listen to ideas or think about anything to do with their existence. Every single moment we have, we fill with distraction. Somebody from one of the addiction centers talks about social media and the addiction to it. It's going to be on the screen. Talks about social media platforms such as Facebook, Snapchat, and Instagram. This, I presume, was written before TikTok took off, but I'm sure we can include it. Produce the same neural circuitry that is caused by gambling and recreational drugs to keep consumers using their products as much as possible. Studies have shown that the constant stream of retweets, likes, and shares from these sites causes the brain's reward area to trigger the same kind of chemical reaction seen with drugs like cocaine. We live in a situation where we are absolutely distracted beyond ourselves. And in this passage, in this book of Haggai, I count three times, there could be more, twice, once at verse 5, once at 7, and once at 2, verse 15, we hear this phrase. And the phrase is this: give careful thought to your ways. Give careful thought to your ways. Now in Hebrew, the actual written there, it basically says, consider twice. Consider. And actually it's two different words it uses. So it's like, stop, halt. Like, you really need to do this. Stop. And think about how you're living. And we're so distracted from it. Proverbs 19:23 says, the fear of the Lord leads to life. And that phrase, the fear of the Lord, simply is a way of saying having a true faith in God, where God is God. And it says, then one rests content. And we're living in the most distracted age of all time, and probably the most discontent age of all time. People are doing, like these people building their houses. Doing, but not content at all about it. And I think for us, and I want to say to the younger people here, hello younger people, hope you're still with us. We older people, us in our beyond the age of 40, us older people, we need to learn from you. I mean that, but there is a generational thing where we need to learn about the world in which you inhabit and live. We need to learn and listen so that we can be involved with you in communicating the good news of Jesus. That we might be able to say, well, what is it to say? Because we think our job is to just sit somebody down and tell them the good news. And if we've engaged with them and they've heard what we've had to say, we think our job is done. And we believe that God's Spirit does it. But we do have a responsibility as well. And back when I was in college, if you had a conversation with somebody, the chances were that within an hour or two you had a conversation about God or Jesus with them, they would have had a moment somewhere to go, oh, I just had a conversation with somebody who told me about somebody called Jesus. I wonder what that means for my life. Those moments don't exist anymore. They're on the bus before, they were thinking about that conversation I just had with Andy. What are they doing now? They're scrolling their Instagram. They're checking the TikTok videos. We've got to find ways to say to people, please, not only hear what I say, but reflect on it. The way we start that is by doing it ourselves. By being reflective people ourselves. I'm not saying social media is bad. There are uses for it. There aren't. It's how it's used. But somebody called Alan Noble, here we go again, he's written a brilliant book on this. There we go. It says, this modern media focuses on largely two goals, capturing our attention and gathering our data. Innumerable gadgets, websites, channels, streaming service, songs, films, and biometric wristbands vie for our attention. Without our attention, their existence is unjustified. So each piece of technology we own does what it can to make us pay attention to it. Like an overly eager child tugging on our sleeve, begging, look what I can do, Dad! Trying to take our attention. Trying to get us to just be constantly engaged with what they have to offer us. And we need to find a new way. We need to find a way of saying stop. Stopping ourselves, modeling it, listening to people, hearing people, listening to what's going on, and saying there is a story about your life. And I finish with this. The story that we give is that there's an invitation that comes from Jesus, who is the one who restores us, who brings contentment to our lives. And Jesus has all kinds of invitations. Come and you will see.
He says, come to me, all that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. If any man is thirsty, come to me and drink. Does anybody even know if they're thirsty at the moment? They stop to wonder. Come, he says, and take up your cross. It's a better way of living. It's a more dynamic, more adventurous way of living than find out if somebody likes a post you've made. Come, says Jesus, and follow me. God calls us to experience his glory because it's what makes us human. He calls us to know him, to love him, to rest in him, to abandon our ways, surrender to the things that we're building in our lives, to relent, to repent, and to be his children, and to be whole because he's made it possible in Jesus Christ. Let's pray.